In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's coolest conversations time in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be speaking today with my fellow Underground Garage disc jockey, Slim Jim Phantom. He hosts his Rockabilly Rave-Up every Sunday evening from between 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern. He's also renowned as a founding member and drummer in the Stray Cats. Their latest single, Stampede, features a cover of the Eddie Cochran tune Teenage Heaven as its B-side, and is also a recent coolest song in the world. Let's give it a listen. And afterwards, I'll be back with Slim for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
I want a house with a pool, a shorter hours in school, and a room with my own private phone. I want to stay up all night, I see the big city lights, no more worries or trouble.
This is the Mighty Manfred with you on your coolest conversations, and what a special one I got lined up for you, because I am speaking with our very own Slim Jim Phantom. You can catch him weekends here at the Underground Garage hosting his Rockabilly Rave-Up every Sunday night from between 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern. Jim, of course, first came to prominence as the drummer of the long-running rockabilly band The Stray Cats. Their new single, Stampede, and its B-side, this new single, Stampede, is out, and its B-side, a cover of the Eddie Cochran tune Teenage Heaven, is this week's coolest song in the world. Slim, my man, how are you?
I'm great, Manfred. It's so cool to sit with an honest mechanic, a fellow honest mechanic. Everyone, you and I are fellow mechanics right here at Little Stephen's Underground Garage, USXM Channel 21. That's us.
That's us. That's you and me. And I love the mechanic thing, man. So, yourself, you were born, I've read this, and I want you to confirm it. So, you were born in Brooklyn, is that right?
Yes.
And you were raised in Massapequa, Long Island?
Yeah, all three of the Stray Cats, we grew up in Massapequa, Long Island. I think I was born in the city. I think the other two were actually born right there. And my father was a fireman in the city, and he wanted to spend his downtime not in the city. So he came out to Long Island. We were about 4 or 5.
And so drums, is that your first instrument?
Yeah, the drums were like probably a lot of drummers, just my thing. And anything on television, anything on the radio, I don't even remember what I liked early on. I liked anything. It didn't quite matter. Set up the pots and pans and the wooden spoons. And after a couple of years of that, they believed you. The parents believed you enough to get a practice pad, and then practice pad enough to like take drum lessons. That was very important. We had to take lessons. And then that advanced to my first drum kit and playing along and with other guys in school, who Lee Rocker from the Stray Cats was always, since the fourth grade, he and I have been playing together.
Wow. All right. So let's actually meet some more about your folks. You mentioned your dad being a fireman. Okay. So moving from these pots and pans to a practice pad on to drums. I mean, so your parents are, and then insisting on lessons. So your parents are encouraging of you playing music then, yeah. Right?
Where we grew up.
Say again?
Where we grew up, it seemed everyone like played guitar or played piano. Every house had a piano in it. And it was just, if you wanted to do it, they accepted it. You had an hour a day to make noise, but you had to take lessons. So we all took lessons at Massapequa Music Store. Everyone in town.
and the drums, man, with your folks, were they ever rolling their eyes saying like, why couldn't you have chosen a piccolo?
Well, my mother used to say that to give me a as a joke when she saw me like loading the stuff into a red wagon and pulling it a few blocks over to Lee's house all the time. But she was also pretty cool and let us rehearse at her house sometimes, so I didn't have to move the drums. No, my mom was okay.
So when I'm talking to people and trying to sort out like how, because you were saying you're listening to anything when you're for a little kid and you're just kind of getting your chops together. And so I tell people, ask people, what are the things you're listening to? Is there like a moment, like an epiphany? Is there some sort of moment where the light bulb goes on? You realize this is what I really want to be doing. And so a lot of the people that I interview or speak with, you know, the Beatles somehow figure into this facet. A lot of them. More recently, like a contemporary thing is like there'll be like the Green Day, but still the Beatles is still the first thing. Rarely is actually Elvis, right? Surprisingly, with Jerry Rosley of the Sonics, he was all about it was Elvis that taught me to lay down the accordion. You know, I wanted to rock when I saw Elvis. What about yourself? Because I know you guys are known for rockabilly, but was it rockabilly sounds that sort of propelled you into having an epiphany, like I want to be this is what I want to do, or did you even have a moment like that? Was it like
positively? And again, I think all roads lead back to Beatles, because I just had whatever records were in the house. Nine, 10 years old, you're not really buying records. That becomes maybe when you're a teenager, a little bit later. And my mother had been given the very first Beatles record as a gag gift. For a birthday of hers. So I listened to that.
Wait, as a gag gift?
Yeah, this would have been about late 60s. I was born in 61. Her friends were a little bit too old to be teeny boppers.
Right.
They bought it for her as like, here's what all the kids are doing these days. You know.
So, well, do you know which one, though?
The very first, Meet the Beatles. The very first.
Okay.
And I had that, and my father, who was a fireman, wasn't a musical cat, but he had a very important record for me. Was he had Hank Williams' Greatest Hits.
Oh, yeah.
And I listened to Hank Williams. They had a Benny Goodman record. They had a Burt Bacharach record with Dionne Warwick singing on it. They had like a little odd, eclectic collection of records, and I just used to play along with them. At that point, I had a practice pad and used a book for the cymbal and a practice pad for the. We'll just play everything, and I would play along with those records. And as time advanced, you got your own rock records. I might have borrowed a Rolling Stones "Get Your Ya-Ya's Out" from my cousin David and my sister, female cousin Carolyn. I borrowed a Peter Frampton from her by the time we're getting into the later mid-70s. So anything I could borrow on a Sunday, we had a big Irish gathering for lunch every Sunday at my Nana's house, and anything I could borrow from them, bring back the next week. So that's how I got rock records, the Stones, Peter Frampton. But when I hit a certain age, I went back to those original records, the Beatles, and I started to get more into the liner notes of it all, like you guys, like you and I always do. And I had the names C. Perkins and B. Holly, and you know, they're the ones that start popping up. I borrowed a Who record from my cousin David one time. E. Cochran. These names start popping up on there. I borrowed an Aerosmith record, J. Burnett. It's Johnny Burnett, Train Kept a Rollin'. Like, so eventually I just start digging back. And by the time I'm in my mid to late teens, I discovered rockabilly. This seems to be the well source of all this stuff that we really like.
Yeah.
And then still for me was any drummer was cool. Any drummer that was on Midnight Special or Don Kirshner Rock Concert, it didn't really matter the band so much, like any drummer was A-okay with me. So studying the drums, finding these old records, which you can kind of trace back. The Stones, you wind up with Chuck Berry. The Beatles, you wind up with Buddy Holly. Really, Beatles, you wind up with Carl Perkins as well, because they did at least two or three of the Carl songs. And then my last year of high school, about 18 years old, I found Elvis. And I knew Elvis from being his final period, I guess you would call, Las Vegas, and it was Elvis Presley. What do you really say about that? He's a big star. And But I didn't know about Memphis Elvis. And when I eventually stumbled upon a picture of the Hillbilly Cat era of Elvis Presley, my world stopped. And in one second, I knew what to do with my life. I went into St. Mark's Place, New York City, cut off all my hair, went across the street to Trash and Vaudeville. I left my polo shirt and flares in the dressing room and came out with a bowling shirt and some baggy pants, Ricky Ricardo pants, we called them.
And,
I went down the street to Andy's Cheapies and I left my Adidas and got some pointy black and white shoes. And I was just transformed. And that was from seeing Elvis Presley and hearing the Sun Sessions. I was taken over by it. I knew the rest of my life, if I worked in the hardware store or I had a job somewhere, I would just do whatever I did, but I would look like Elvis Presley, 1956. That's what I wanted to, that's all I cared about.
So. You know, I used to work in record stores for a long time, and I was there. This was in Athens, and a kid comes in, and he'd been listening to the Flat Duo Jets, and he was like, I really enjoy this rockabilly stuff. I want to find out more about rockabilly music. I was, this is great. And so I laid down the Sun Sessions, right, Elvis Sun Sessions, and he just shook his hand. He said, no, I want the real stuff, you know, like the real stuff. And I was like, it starts here, buddy. It really starts here. And it was hard to get him because all he could think of was a guy in a jumpsuit in Vegas. And it was really hard. And it's so cool that you had this impression, but that didn't keep you from recognizing the brilliance when you saw the Hillbilly Hat.
Well, the Hillbilly Cat knows that era of photos. And by that time, the three of us had found each other. Although we'd known each other our whole lives, we found each other. Brian's 2 years older than Lee and me.
I want to interrupt here because there's something about we hadn't touched on that I think is pretty important because you were talking about everybody takes these lessons in this music store. And the guy that I came across that was your drum teacher, a guy named Mousie Alexander.
Yes.
He seems to be quite the character. Can you tell us some about him first?
Yeah.
Like Mousie and what was he like to work with?
Sure. Mousie Alexander, I found through like a local newspaper or some ad at the library or something. And he lived about two, three train stops over in like Wantagh, Merrick. I live on the South Shore of Long Island is where we grew up. And it's all a series of train stops. Massapequa Park, Massapequa, Seaford, Belmar, Amityville, Seaford, Wantagh, Belmar, Merrick, Rockville Center, change at Jamaica for points. It was that one train line that went all the way along the south coast of Long Island. And so two or three of those towards the city was Wantagh, and that's where Mousie Alexander had a little studio in his basement. And he was an old jazz cat. He was 5 foot tall. He had a goatee. He had a beret. And he really did say daddy-o. For real. He spoke that way. What's up, cat? You know, I arrived and his wife would let me in. I'd have my drum book and my pair of sticks. And he had his basement converted into a little studio. I had two drum kits. And he had played with Benny Goodman. He had played with Dinah Washington. He had done a brief stint with, I think, Count Basie. He had done a tour of Japan, I remember, with Dinah Washington telling me about the Far East tour there. And he was a real dyed-in-the-wool jazz cat. No irony, he was that guy. And he had me concentrate on rudiments, and I wanted to, play a lot of stuff. And he said, well, we sit down for half an hour, and we go, bop, boom, bop, 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 boom, bop, bop. And then next week I'll let you put the kick drum in there, and it was pretty much very rudimental what he taught me. And I still wind up using the same licks. I took lessons from him 2-3 years, and it was a magical thing.
Oh, very cool. All right. So you're taking lessons from him. You've known Lee Rocker from, you said like in the fourth grade.
Yeah.
So what drew you to Lee? Did you recognize in him as being a fellow weirdo?
But way back in the fourth grade, through school, it was like, well, this is the guy that plays the bass, you're the guy that plays the drums. So we spent a lot of time throughout junior high, beginning of high school, just playing the two of us.
Yeah.
In a room, and he would go boom, and I would go bop, and he would go boom, and I would go bop, and we loved rhythm sections. We would listen to Mick Fleetwood and John McVie, and we would listen to Bill and Charlie, and we listen to records as rhythm sections. And we had a very we had a head start in a funny way for being in a trio, because we worked just, and then we had bands with, we have other guys in there, but we spent a lot of time on our own, just bass and drums, practicing in his mom's garage, also in Massapequa. And I parked my drums there for a little while, a couple of years. And his mom was a musician, so they didn't care if he went over there and practiced, kind of thing. So, so we were musicians, and we had 100 bands. And Brian Setzer was, we also knew him quite well, but he was 2 years older than us.
Okay.
Same school, same everything, but he was two over us.
You know what? I want to interject here that Brian Setzer seems to be a very fortunate man to have met you guys that already had this symbiotic rhythm section relationship going on. Now, when does he realize this?
We're about 16. He's about 18.
Yeah, yeah.
17 maybe. And he was virtuoso. He's a beautiful musician. When he was 11, like, the jazz teacher couldn't really teach him too much, you know. It was like he was already kind of plowed through all the different books and everything. And he was a cool guy. He was like kind of the first one in our school that like had an earring, and he was the first one that was hip to Bowie. No, he was a cool guy.
Yeah.
And he was 2 years older than us, so we looked up to him a little bit. And and his brother was Lee and my, he was in our class. So we would go over their house to hang out, watch him practice, and he had bands that we would go and see. And
so one of these bands was the Tomcats. Was that a band?
Well, the Tomcats was the Stray Cats, but we used to
brother or not.
Excuse me?
So Brian's brother, was he in the Tomcats early on?
No, Brian's brother was in a band with Brian called Bloodless Pharaohs.
Okay.
And they played like CBGBs, Maxes, and that kind of stuff. And Lee and I had another band called Shylocks. Kind of a dumb name, but we played around a lot as well. So at some point, we would cross paths quite a bit. And this is 1978. And I discovered rockabilly, and so had Brian. So I started to dress that way, even though I wasn't playing rockabilly music in the band. With Lee and me, we were contemporary, we were blues, we knew all the shuffles, and because a bunch of the older guys would have Lee and I play with them because they didn't have to pay us. And they would put us in the back of a bar. We were 16, they were 19, whatever. But back then, that's a big three-year difference. Yeah. So they would sneak Lee and me into the back of these blues clubs around Long Island. We would drive. We just wanted to play. So Lee and I would play shuffles all night long. And so we had a lot of experience playing together. So when I found rockabilly, the image of it, I had my hair cut. I walked around in fleck jackets, black and white shoes, high hair, blue, the baggy pants. And I just loved it. And I was continuing to play all these different bands with a blues band, with a band with Lee. Just, I would just look that way.
Yeah.
So the tide was changing, and I noticed Brian, maybe even a little before me, he had started dressing that way. And we would all go to each other's gigs. And I saw him, and he said, "Oh, you're my brother's friend. Of course, Jim, you dress this way too?" I said, "Yeah, yeah, I love it." And I had my drums in my car coming from rehearsal to go see Brian. And at that point, Brian had been doing his own band, but he had been doing this rockabilly thing with a rhythm box on a stool, just because he loved this music, and he would go to some lounge. They'd pay him $40, whatever. He would play all night, but with a rhythm box, just him in the box. So I said, "Dude, I have my drums in my car." He says, "Well, for my second set, why don't you bring them out?" So Brian Setzer and me did what became the Stray Cats, kind of White Stripes style, for a little while.
And this is what year then? Is this 79 or not?
78, 79, 79 probably. And that's after a few of those, I said to Brian, "You know our friend Lee?" "Yeah, he was my brother's class." Yeah. "He has one of those double basses. He's cool looking too. Well, next week I have the gig in the same place. Let's do it." So we brought the bass. I told Lee, get one of these double basses. And it's the same time that the Buddy Holly movie came out with Gary Busey. It's around that time. And it was getting not hip, but like it was on pop culture radar a little bit. So he got a bass. He cut his hair. We turned up at Brian's gig, and the three of us just sounded good right away.
Yeah.
That'll Be the Day and Bebopalula and, you know, whatever the standards for rockabilly music were, 20 Flight Rock. It just sounded good immediately. And then we pursued that as our main band. Then we just started to play all the bars on Long Island. Four sets a night, five nights a week.
That's wow. All right. So were you ever playing? I mean, I know you guys moved to the UK in like 1980. Yeah. I asked you about that.
1980. But... So by the time we moved to England, we had about a year.
Before you do that, you're playing there in Long Island. Are you playing in New York City at all? Do you play that any like CBGBs or any of that stuff before you go overseas?
The kind of dream was to get good, and then once a month you could go into CBGB's, Max's Kansas City, Hurrah. There was like two or three of them. Yeah. And they would only have you every month, maybe once a month, because they didn't want your draw to be diluted, right? So we played on Long Island. We were a bit too weird for the established rock clubs because we were dressed up to the nines. 24/7, having to get into little scuffles at 7-Eleven. A guy didn't like you wearing a pink jacket, or you know, just it was a constant battle. And by that point, Brian Setzer and I shared a flat size of that room you're in, you know. And it was just rockabilly. We had a big pile of clothes, records, and we lived that way for about a year or so. And it was beautiful because it was as we had imagined Elvis. Living in Memphis.
Yeah.
Up to the gigs in my car, an old Bonneville with the bass sticking out of the window and the three of us across the front. Like, we really lived that style. And we started doing quite well because we had 5-6 gigs a week. $300 a show. We split the money, 100 each. So, like, we're cashed up as kids on Long Island. And at the same time, getting very good at it, because we played four sets a night, five nights a week, one gig at Amityville, one gig in Belmore, one gig way out in like some swinging singles bar on Long Island out by the Hamptons, and a couple gigs by the, and then once a month at the City, hoping that a record company or a journalist might come see you. You know, that didn't seem to happen. And although we were making money and having some fun, we knew there was more to it, kind of. So decided to move to England, because we were getting the music papers, the NME, the Melody Maker from like Bleecker Bob. They're 2 months late, whatever, but we were getting them. And it just seemed like everyone was rock and roll over there. We'd read about the Clash and the Pretenders and the Pistols and the whole scene. King's Road, we thought everywhere was like that. So we sold everything and left, went to England.
You guys sat down and you said, man, this is Nowheresville. We got to get to England. That's where it's happening.
Exactly. They know who Gene Vincent is there. Eddie Cochran's a household name. And like, nobody knew what we were doing. They liked it. Yeah. The 80 kids, whatever, that came every night that paid our bills. They weren't rockabilly. They just saw us as local eccentrics. And, you know, they liked it to go out and dance. And it was all the bars that we played at had a good scene. They didn't know that it was rockabilly. They were watching a rockabilly revolution. They just knew it was a band. And we were called the Tomcats then. Would be playing at their local corner bar. So five or six of those a week. And then one in the City. So we were quite tight at it. Quite good. You know, we knew 100 songs. And so we went to England. And
you sold your instruments to get the airplane tickets? Is that right?
We sold everything. I think Brian had a bunch of amps, maybe. He kept one guitar, the Gretsch. I sold my drums but kept the snare drum. We had to take the bass because that was kind of a unique thing. And we had to buy a seat for it.
So we strapped
in. And no one seemed to really noticed that much until we went there. We tried to get into England. We were clearly a band.
Right.
Tried to go to different lines, and they scooped us all together, and they gave us a real hassle getting in. We didn't have any visa, any work permit, any phone number, any address, any, we had, you know, $1,000. We thought it was $1 million, you know, and they gave us a lot of trouble getting in, secondary screening and deportation room. And then somehow they let us in with a special 2-week visa. And
so a special 2-week visa. So, but there must have been some chastising about you can't play music over here.
Yeah. The 2 weeks was supposed, I forget the exact wording, but failure to leave will result in deportation with prejudice. You know, so we were supposed to look for job, you know, call our parents and get the money sent to get the plane, because we had 1-way plane tickets. So we
so just, you had 1-way tickets. You show up with a double bass, his acoustic bass, standing up there. First, you did not. You must be done. Oh no, we're not a band, and they're shaking their head. Look at you guys, obviously a band, and yet they still let you in. That's incredible.
Yeah, well, with extreme prejudice, and like Peter, you know, the story goes that like after we had a success, we got the visas fixed by the record company that eventually signed us 6 months later, and we would go in and out of England quite a lot, to France, yeah, to Germany, to Holland, to do TV shows, appearances, things like that. And there was the one woman that didn't want to let us in, and she hated us. And she saw us every time we went in and out. She would mean face us. Like, but we were bulletproof at that point, because we had become members of the British Musicians Union, and we had the proper So we go to London, we vanish into the London underworld, and just we went to Piccadilly Circus, because we had heard of that from TV. The subway station had big lockers, so we stuffed the bass and the guitar, most of the luggage, in these lockers that when they have a key and you carry the key around. And we just wandered around in London trying to meet people, go to parties that we heard of. We look in the back of the Time Out magazine where all the gigs were, and just turn up at things that we thought were cool. The Clash, this Pretenders, anything we thought sounded, Motorhead, things that sounded cool. We would somehow get there.
And your first gig there?
Well, from hanging around, this would have been the summer of 1980.
Yeah.
Hanging around, we looked quite outrageous, because at this point we have a pink suit on, but it's kind of dirty, you know. We're hungry. We had no prospect, and so we cut quite interesting characters. And so from hanging around enough, England back then had these rock pubs, the Golden Lion, the Greyhound, the Marquee, the Dingwalls, the Venue. Like, they had a series of rock pubs, more or less, where the music would start in the afternoon. People would go, hipsters would go, 4, 5, 6, 7 o'clock gigs, and then you go to the real the nightclubs after that, then the after hours, then so we had been hanging around at these pubs where bands were playing. Bands that would be in England in 1980 were doing this pub rock circuit. So we just hung around there long enough, and we had met the Pretenders, we had met the Clash, we had met the Sex Pistols, we had met the Damned, people like that, because they would be hanging around the punk rock pub circuit, and we looked quite the part. We weren't afraid to talk to anybody. We were New York types. And so finally we knocked on enough doors that they gave us a few of these gigs. Go on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, play for 20 minutes. But we would tell the owner, yeah, we're this great band. We're from New York. We, you know, we can play, we can do this, we can do that. And eventually nightclubs, bars, they need bands too. There was 5 bands a night, 7 nights a week there too. So they rolled the dice, and we got a gig at the Fulham Greyhound, the Golden Lion. There was a one called the Thomas A. Beckett that was a boxing pub right out of Quadrophenia. They had a boxing ring and then a stage. We went and we played, and we did our thing. We had 20 minutes, so we looked at each other and we just went for it. We threw the guitar in the air, we jumped off the drum, we spun the bass, we crashed into each other, we got into an argument. Brian jumped into the audience and kicked everyone's pint glass. We did the whole act in 20 minutes. We did this for about a week or so. And then Joe Strummer starts to notice. Chrissie Hynde was there. Lemmy was there. Glenn Matlock and Steve Jones were there. Paul Simonon from The Clash is there. So we've got 20 people in the audience, but it's the face, the tastemakers of that era.
Yeah.
So Strummer goes and does an interview for Melody Maker next week. So what are you doing, Joe? Well, I'm working on the new Clash album, and I saw this band from New York. You wouldn't even believe them. Chrissy Hynde is a big champion of us because she's American. She had a kind of a similar thing happen to her when she moved to England. She's working in a store, and she did. And I met Lemmy, who became my friend until the day he kicked the bucket from them. Chrissy Hynde, her boyfriend at the time was Ray Davies. She brought him. He talked about it in the paper. So about 2 weeks into this run of gigs, we get a phone call that a certain band wants the table in front. So we asked them if they could, and that band turned out to be the Rolling Stones. So yeah. All of them came, the whole band.
They're seated in line at the table. I mean, they're just one right next to each other at this table.
In front of the stage, just right there. It's paparazzi around them, not around us. It's a pub. There's, you know, 30 people there, whatever. So and they loved it. They flipped out because they have their ear to the ground, those guys. They're as much as you want to think someone like the Stones are in an ivory tower, detached from what's going on, they're still, to this day, I believe, they're tuned in. They know what's happening. So 1980, they had just started a record label. They were looking for cool stuff. So they loved it. There was paparazzi there, so they're taking pictures. So the next day, we're not on page 6 of a rock magazine. We're on page 3 of the daily newspaper. Rolling Stones at some unknown band, you know, picture of like Mick Jagger hugging Brian or whatever. Like, so it's like, what, who is this? What's going on? So that's when the record labels really got interested in us. And it became a big buzz around town. And the Stones wanted to sign us. We went to Keith's house for one weekend, and then we went to mix the amazing flat in London one time. But they were feeding us and giving us beer. This is as much as I ever hoped for. So, but we couldn't quite get it together.
I mean, your heads must be exploding at this point.
Yeah, and we're hungry as well. So Mick says, "Any fancy a sandwich?" We're like, they brought in a tray of sandwiches. And then he said, "Mick, you have a call from America." So he had to leave the room. And we looked at each other, and we just dove into the sandwiches. He comes back in. And this is why he's a cool guy, man, to this day. He came back, and there was a plate of sandwiches devoured. Maybe a crust of bread left in us. Let's go. He never said one word. He didn't say one single word. And so we met with them, and then a bunch of other labels. We met with Richard Branson. He really liked us. He took us to a nice dinner. So we're continuing to play these pubs because now we're getting rebooked because we're causing a scene around town. We got into these music papers. A bunch of faces are coming to see us. And we still have no money and nowhere to live. So eventually we... the people from Arista Records, Tarquin Gotch, Simon Potts, guys who played a big role in Arista, they really believed in it. They could get the money. They could get the contract. At the same night they came to court us, Dave Edmonds had come to that gig. And because Edmonds had been there in secret like 5-6 times, he wanted to produce us. He explained it like he felt like he was Sam Phillips. And he had been looking for a rockabilly band young enough, American enough, but we got English culture a little bit. We weren't, you know, that he could kind of mold, or that had the sound that he heard in his head, because he couldn't make that sound.
Right.
So Edmonds was there. The record company was there. We kind of made a soft agreement in a dressing room. And then very quickly, they got us a flat. They got us a little bit of like steady, you know, each, you know, you get 20 pounds a week each kind of thing. And we signed with Arista Records, and then very quickly in the studio. And we had Stray Cats.
I hear about Dave Edmonds. You know, he suffered, from what I understand, is a really terrible stroke this year.
Yeah, over the summertime, yeah.
Must have been making a recovery that better than what has been.
He is. We had stayed in touch with his wife, and he had a stroke very badly, and he was not responsive for a while, but now I think he's a little bit conscious, you know. I don't think he's ever going to be back to 100% again.
Oh.
But he is alive. So wow. 1980, yeah, we signed with Arista Records and went in very quickly with Edmonds because they believed in him. We believed in him. Yeah. We met with Edmonds one time socially first at his house. He had a little pub in his basement. Like in England, everything is like just a little smaller. The houses are a little small. He had a finished basement like we would have in Long Island, right? But it was tiny. He had like one of those half-size pool tables, and he had a small jukebox. It was funny. But on the jukebox, he had Carl Perkins and Johnny Burnett, and then Brian and I both know he had The Races On by George Jones. So we noticed that, said, this is the guy for us, you know? And Arista made an offer for a record contract contingent upon him being the producer. So so we went in very quickly and did Runaway Boys was the first single. And then the album was out in by Christmas. And we had reached the top 10. When charts froze over Christmas, you know, the end of the year chart, we were number 9 and we did Top of the Pops. And so it was kind of that we went there in June and were homeless. And then in December, we had a record in the charts. It was like, we did everything we said we were going to do. As crazy as it sounded, we did it.
I know, that's just it's incredible. Well, and so going forward, those first couple of albums here stateside, there's like three top 10 hits. There's Rock This Town, yeah. Straight Strut, Sexy and Seven.
What happened was the record deal that we signed in England had a clause that was ex North America, not meaning that we used to be from North America, but ex standing for excluding. So most record contracts that were signed in London were excluded for North America because it's a big expense for a label to try to break a band in the USA. They don't want that commitment too early. So if you did well around the world, it was up to the label to release your record in the States. Like if you sign in the States, maybe it's reverse. Maybe they ex-European or whatever. I'm not sure of. But so we spent the first 2 years, almost 3 years, just playing around Europe. We went to Japan a few times, Australia. And we had two albums that were both very successful. So 1982, we want to come back. We're from America. We want to be in the States. And this is American music. And we want to... So we have meetings with Arista, and for whatever the reason, I'll never know, they decided not to release the record in America. They passed on us. So we were back to square one. We had no deal. They didn't want to pay us the third album because by the third album, the advances are pretty high, you know, because so they dropped us. Not only didn't release us in America, but dropped us. And that's when a very interesting guy named Gary Gersh, who was president of EMI.
Okay.
He would go on to sign Nirvana when he worked for Geffen. He was a cool guy. He had been following what was going on in England. He had just kind of followed what we were doing. And he said, well, I'll pick up the contract. So EMI bought the two records from Arista, made that a compilation. We put a couple new songs on it, and that became the first American album. So it was in reality our third album, but the first that was got a release in the States. So then we just started all over again. Went in the tour bus for a year and watched the record slowly climb the charts. And a lot of that had to do with the invention around this time of MTV, which made the biggest difference in the world because we were kind of a visual band. We were young, we were dressed up, in England, most bands made a video for a promotional tool because you couldn't be in Germany and France at the same time kind of thing. So if you were appearing in France and asked to be on TV in Germany, and they all had those Top of the Pops, Solid Gold, American Bandstand, they had a few of those shows in every country in Europe. So when you couldn't make it there, you would give them this promo clip. You know, we now wind up calling them videos, but back then they were called promo reels or whatever. So we already had two or three of them from England. So when they start MTV, believe it or not, they don't have enough content.
Right, I remember that.
You need videos. Like, so, okay, you play 20 videos. That's 1 hour. We got 23 more hours. That was their business model. So they were scouring, and we had two, I believe now, videos from England that they just put into rotation in the USA. And I think you notice that a lot of the first wave MTV bands would have been like Culture Club, Duran Duran, Susie and the Banshees, Thompson Twins, like, because they had videos. MTV didn't set out to be an English invasion. That was just the videos that they had in their possession. So we bumped in with that because we made the record in England, and we got sent the same thing. And a lot of those bands like us, the first record was on import.
Yeah.
Like in LA, they had Import Alley. That was a show on K, where Rodney, where our fellow mechanic Rodney Bingenheim started. His channel was the big import radio station here in LA. And they were playing us quite a lot. And we didn't know until we came to LA and we had a line around the block playing at the Whiskey, just because Rodney and his other and the other guys on his channel were playing our record a lot as an import. So real radio stuff, you know? And so between MTV and people like Rodney, we had a little bit of a leg up in the States without knowing.
And so you're back here in the States. You get you have several top 10 hits here in the U.S. And then, like in 1984, the band winds up breaking up, and you know you reform on and off again since that period of time. But what was the reason that in 84 that I'm assuming here, and correct me, Brian Setzer is like, no, we're done with this now. I mean, what
make a solo album? He wanted to make a solo album, which didn't make sense to me. So two long guys from Long Island, they don't really sit down and calmly discuss what's bothering them and get to their true inner feelings. So we had a bit of a fight, you know, and so he went and made a solo record. Lee and I recruited a guy named Earl Slick, and we made a solo album that Keith Richard appeared on, and Nicky Hopkins, and, you know, Brian made a very nice solo record. Lee and I made a very nice solo record. And by the time we got back together, I think a lot of that had to do with Edmonds in a funny way. He was playing around in L.A., Rockpile, one of his things, and Brian and I, of course, both happened to be there. We see each other. I love you, man. I love you, man. You know, we got back together for Dave, but we were still in the midst of making a solo record, I think. And then it took another year to get it together. And then 88, I don't know if we reformed or just started doing it again. I don't know how official it was. We went into Capitol Studios here in LA and worked with Dave Edmonds again. I think Edmonds was a bit of a, you know, an older brother. He kind of like, come on, you guys, stop fighting, and got us back together again. But by this point, we had a success. Everyone's a little bit successful and a bit, you know, I don't want to say jet set, but we're like, you know, kind of better off than we were when we were home. Yeah. So that just means everything takes a little longer, you know. So Edmonds came from London to see us. He came to my house to visit, and then he went to see Brian. And then, you know, he was helping to get us back together. And we were still under contract to EMI, Brian and me, as solo artists and as the Stray Cats. So let's do another record. So that's when we did a record called Blast Off that did pretty good. We got back together again, and that was 88. And then we kept going until the 90s, and that's when Brian started to do his orchestra.
Right.
And that's when we took a break for about 7-8 years or so. But since then, we've been doing it every few years on tour.
Yeah. And so that nature, that on again, off again nature, you guys are resolved with that. I mean, that's okay.
Oh yeah. Now, because it's very, we become somehow elder statesmen in a funny way, you know, and it's, and the Stray Cats is one of those bands. It really just never went away, and it's kind of too old to beat around the bush anymore. I think we're the best at that genre, and that's always going to rise. I mean, if you go out in the street and ask someone name one rockabilly group, they're going to know the Stray Cats, you know? And I think what we did, organically was we created a kind of a new sound. And I it's an adjective in a funny way now, because we used to try to explain to people what it was. And we love rockabilly. We're like 90% rockabilly, but we also loved the Clash and the Sex Pistols. So we tried to blend a little bit of punk rock into rockabilly. And now if a band is trying to pitch themselves, they say, what do you sound like? Well, we're kind of like the Stray Cats. And then you kind of know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's become a little bit of an adjective, the Stray Cats. And I think when you get older, you kind of appreciate that stuff. And all those cats like Carl Perkins and Wanda Jackson and the people that we love that were our heroes really embraced it. And they got in touch with us over the years. And I would consider, I mean, both Carl and Wanda were my friends. I mean, Wanda still is. But like to be accepted by the ones that were your heroes was a very big thing. So, and I think that carried over to like now we're still the torchbearers of the whole thing, you know?
Right. And so over the course of the career, there's these kind of ups and downs, on again, off again. But it seems this year especially, there's been a lot of sort of roller coaster stuff happening, because Brian, he made this announcement back in like February, towards the beginning of the year, that he had this autoimmune disease and he would not be playing guitar anymore. And then a few months later, it's like, oh no, I'm getting better. I can play again. We're going to record. And then there's going to be this tours, et cetera. So initially, let's go back to the beginning of this year. He makes this announcement. He's got this disease. Well, when did you hear about that? How did you deal with it?
Well, I heard from him first, because everyone's pretty close. He lives in Minneapolis. Lee lives in New York. I live in LA, but we're very close. Not having lunch close, but like still close. You know how it is with a band. You know, it's kind of like your army buddies or something. It's more than just hanging out. There's a certain, you know, you have
only. You mentioned when you guys were seeing each other, and after a period of time, you're like, I love you, brother. You're my, you know, yeah. I love. That's true, because the band was forged in the fire, right? You know, I mean, these intense experiences, you're having to rely on each other, not just to get through the day, but you're also on stage together. I mean, you can't
get in a bed. The three of us shared a toothbrush. I mean, in the early days, we were homeless. We used to get, a hamburger from the Wimpy's, which there's their version of McDonald's in England, right? And do bites. You know, you take a bite, I take a bite, you take a bite. We had one Coca-Cola, right? You know, that's how we lived for 6 months, you know? So, so that's deep, I think. So, we were speaking a lot at that time, because we were going to do a tour back then. This was April last year, March and April. And Brian was losing the feeling in his hands. He thought he couldn't play anymore. So he makes the announcement, which the three of us knew, but he makes this announcement that was shocking. And then he went into a different clinic. He found a new doctor that specialized in autoimmune, and he was doing these treatments, these infusion treatments. And he would call me every week from the Mayo Clinic. And it's starting to work, man. I got 30% of my hand back, and now I can hold a pencil. And so this took 6 months. By the end of June, he was like, dude, my hands came back. It's a special combination of drugs that has worked. These doctors here are beautiful. So he reached the end of his treatment. We announced this tour, which sold very well. It was going to be very, very successful. We're in the theater for the first night outside Detroit, Michigan. We had sold 3,500 tickets. People in the audience. Seats. I'm getting ready. And he called me and he said, I can't do it. This has come back. He was trying to not tell anyone because he figured it would come back. You know, that's why it's the time. And he said, I was praying that it would come back and it didn't. I can't do the gig tonight. And you hear a pebble in the water. This was like a boulder in the water, because it affects a lot of people. And first and foremost, we want our friend to be healthy. You know, he's a guitar player extraordinaire, so his hands are like, you know, if a fish can't swim. I mean, he's that guy that plays the guitar 8 hours a day. If he's in a good mood, he plays guitar 8 hours a day if he's in a bad mood. You know, it's like his thing, and couldn't do it. So we had to, you know, get the people out of the theater, cancel the show, send the crew home, all this kind of, which is still, it's still fresh. It's just happened. So it's, and he's trying to get back into that same clinic to restart his, you know, the treatments that seem to be working, maybe have to do them longer. That, you know, the medical part, I don't know about, but yeah. He, I mean, he couldn't hold the guitar. He couldn't feel the strings on his finger, you know?
And now when he was able to start playing again, that's when you guys went in and he recorded the single?
Yeah, that was August. And he lives in Minneapolis. So we went to Minneapolis and found a great studio. There's a lot of studios in Minneapolis that Prince used to record there. that's the thing in Minneapolis. They're all Prince's studio somehow. And so we went in there and we made a great record, you know, the two songs that we have now, but we were doing other things. And I stayed at his house like the old days. And we just turned up at the studio every day for about a week, did good work. And it was the plan, you know,
the single Stampede's the A side. And if the B side features our coolest song in the world this week, your version of Eddie Cochran's Teenage Heaven. You mentioned the Rolling Stones being there on that table down front, in front of the stage when we were playing the pub, and spoke about, you know, the sandwiches with Jagger. Now, he suggested the Teenage Heaven that you guys covered. Is that right?
All those years ago, he saw a set. We probably did 20 Flight Rock or some Eddie Cochran song. I'm sure there was one in there. And he said, you guys should do Teenage Heaven. Do you know that one? Sure, of course. Said that'd be a great song. And I think he wanted to take us in and record it, you know, with us. That never actually materialized all these years later. And then you'd bump into people at an airport I would go to the Rolling Stones gig, and he was always very nice. We were always welcome to the gigs. Yeah. Bill Wyman is my friend, my pal. But you'd go to the gigs and you'd see them all. They were very nice. They knew us because we did a tour with them in 81. They took us on the 81 Tattoo You tour here in the States. Nobody knew us because the record had been released in America yet, but they really liked us. And that was a challenge every night to go out in front of 30,000 Rolling Stones people who had never heard of you before, but we won the crowd every night. And Sir Mick was very nice. Always. I don't call him on the phone, but like see him once in a while, kind of. Yeah. And he would always say, did you ever do that Eddie Cochran song? So he remembered. So when it came time to get ready for what songs we were going to do, it was Brian that had remembered. I said, he said, Eddie Cochran, Teenage Heaven. Yeah, of course. It's a beautiful song. And remember Mick Jagger told us to do it? And I said, oh, yeah, he did. So that's the rock story part of it, you know. And then we sent it. Of course, Stevie loved that one.
Well, yeah. And so you never, until you recorded it, you had not, it wasn't like you've been playing that live for a while.
Oh, because we do something else. We do Come On Everybody. We do Summertime Blues. We do 20 Flight Rock. I think we used to do My Way. Like, we know every Eddie Cochran song. But for that one, we had never played live before. So it was kind of cool to, like, you know how it is. Like, sure, I know that one. But then when you actually play it, it's not exactly how you thought it was until you do it, you know. And then you realize, especially with those ones, it's even better than you remembered it, you know.
Tell me some about this Chris Lord-Alge, because you've worked with him in the past, right? Did he produce the recordings?
He mixed everything. Brian and I and Lee recorded everything. And ever since the first few records, we could, I think we know how to produce a record, but like, we always like having somebody there. I mean, Edmonds was always there, kind of. He was our George Martin, whatever. He was the older guy in the room kind of thing. Now we're all old. It doesn't matter. But, like, we always liked having somebody there because these kind of guys know more than you. They really do about making records. So
it's easier. I mean, so you guys have got your history between the three of you, and it is easier for the fourth voice to be able to point something out that
exactly,
you know, amongst yourselves, you might be like, well, that's kind of how it is. I'm, you know, I don't know whether it's really addressing this.
Exactly. But we always wind up saying, what would Edmonds do?
Yeah. Well, that's a good, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, what happened with, was, Chris Lord, I mean, I had met him. I think he actually had done a record with my wife a long time ago, which is funny. He had mixed a couple songs for Brian in the past. So Brian had thought of him and, okay, that's a good idea. And so we had agreed in Nashville. We were in Minneapolis. Then I think I was going to Nashville with my wife because she was going to start her session there. Mm-hmm. On the way to Nashville, where in the plane and sitting next to us is a guy that I didn't know who it was. And Jenny said, I think that's Chris Lord. Chris Lord. And he recognized her because she had mixed a band that she was in 10 years ago. And yes, she said, and my husband is here. Slim, I just got the tapes to mix the Stray Cats song. And I'd never met the guy before. And we live kind of close to each other, it turns out. But that's just goes to show you the kismet of rock and roll. I mean, so we had everything on tape. And then we gave it to Chris Lord, Algy, to mix it.
Yeah.
It came out beautiful. He's like, you know him, he's worked with Green Day. I mean, he's kind of got... He's got 10 Grammys, I think, the guy. And he's I immediately knew who he was, but he's worked on all these records that you love so much that, you know, he knew Brian. So Brian suggested him, and Brian's a pretty smart guy, you know. So we just said yes to Chris Lord Algy. And then I met him on the airplane. Okay, he's cool.
That's cool. Well, let's talk some about the A-side Stampede. So did Brian write the tune?
Yes. I think it might have been one of these, like a standard, which I don't know, like from the 30s or something, like an instrumental song, which he's like changed around a lot and wrote lyrics to it. And I think they made the deal with a publisher. There's like another writer listed on that along with him.
Okay. All right. And what was the process with the songwriting process with you guys? Would he or does he typically make a demo of the song and send that to you? Or does he, guys sort of work it up in the studio together or what is
usually the last two albums, we made an album in 2019 that was good. Number three in Billboard chart. I don't know if it means exactly the same thing anymore, but it did do well, you know, and that enabled us to tour that year, which was great because 2020 was kind of a bad year, you know. And that's when we formed in 1979 and we wanted to do a 40th anniversary. So the business, the label, management, agent came and said, why don't you just wait till 2020 because your first record came out in 1980. So 40 years would be 2020. They're all nice round numbers, look good on a poster. We said, no. And the three of us one time, we really did agree. We said, we formed in 1979. We don't want anyone to think that we just appeared in 1980 as this fully formed, you know, 1979, we did four sets a night, five nights a week for a year, man. So we convinced everyone that what our vision was to do it for 1979 to 2019. And I'm so happy we did that because 2020, no one did anything.
Yes.
We had this record that we actually did in 2018 and it was released in 2019 and we did a world tour. So that was a very good thing. So, and on that record, Brian had written a bunch of songs and he sent Lee and myself very crude demos that had like a rhythm box on it, very crude drum machine, him singing and playing acoustic guitar. And I just practiced along to him 1,000 times and came up with parts for them and Lee the same thing. So that time we went into the studio in Nashville, we did that. Of course, the songs that changed a little bit, but we kind of knew what they were going to be. Whereas in the past, sometimes we'd turn up with nothing and you write songs at $500 an hour at Capitol, you know? You play ping pong and pool for $500 an hour and while someone comes up with an idea. So we did not do that. We've matured a little bit. We started in the daytime. It wasn't like arriving at 9 o'clock at night. Everyone got there at noon, had lunch, played, finished at eight. It was very, very civilized and different than the chaotic way everyone used to do it. So we made that excellent record and then couldn't record. We didn't record again until this little batch of songs. So, and again, we did this in Minneapolis, and I think we want to do a whole record. Brian's gone back and hopefully he'll get his treatment retreated and up onward and upward, you know, but right now it's a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah. Well, please give our best to Brian. I mean, we're hoping that this going back to the Mayo Clinic, you know, he'll be at the same point shortly. Initially was getting better. And Slim, man, thanks so much for hanging out with me, for speaking with me on today's Coolest Conversations.
Well, we're tight. We Honest Mechanics at the Underground Garage, there's not really that many of us. And I think it's a tight gang. And I'm always kind of thrilled and pleased that I met Stevie and that we let me in the gang. I mean, it's a beautiful thing to be right here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I love it.
Well, I want to remind folks as well to be sure and to check out your Rockabilly Ravo every Sunday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern. And now we're going to take a listen to the A-side. We're going to have a stampede from the Stray Cats here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. The Stray Cats here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with the A-side to their latest single, Stampede. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band Slim Jim Phantom for speaking with me. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing our podcast, Your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.